Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. With the world's largest national security budget, just how safe are we in this country? My guest today would argue that our billions of dollars in post-9/11 defense spending has brought us a false sense of security and diverted money from worthier efforts, including providing health care for all American children. Robert Scheer has been a journalist for more than three decades. These days, he is based at the San Francisco Chronicle, and he edits the website truthdig.com. His new book is called The Pornography of Power: How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. Robert, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You write that 9/11 served as a kind of gift for neoconservative ideologues. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, George Bush's father, who's now more and more looking like a great president, the first Bush president, acknowledged that with the demise of the Soviet Union, it was time for a peace dividend. And he ordered his defense secretary, Dick Cheney, to implement a 30% cut in defense spending. And there was great alarm throughout what General Eisenhower turned President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, which, as President Eisenhower warned, had its tentacles in every congressional district, jobs, profit dependent upon it, campaign contributions, and so forth. And so this was a historic moment. The collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, was a great gift, if you want to use that word, to the American people, to the world's people. It was time for a peace dividend. We'd had a permanent war economy since beginning of World War II, and it was now time to put it back into domestic spending. Those are the words of the first President Bush, and the movement was underway. And then Bill Clinton, even though he was afraid of being called weak on defense, as Democrats always are, still went along with this plan, not as aggressively as maybe the first President Bush would have done, but still Bill Clinton went along. And there was great fear in the defense industry and those who benefit from it, including some of the think tanks and certainly politicians. And the neoconservatives, who had been at war with any a notion of a more peaceful world ever since Richard Nixon made his historic trip to China. Nixon was their big enemy. And any idea of accommodation, diplomacy, non-military means of dealing with the world what was seen as appeasement, they were alarmed. They had all sorts of plans of a revitalized American military. But until 9/11, there really was no rational argument that they could advance for a new Cold War, a resurgence of military spending. And when 9/11 happened, without really knowing very much about what had caused it and who are these people and what were the different roles, one of the first things that the new President Bush did was ask for $20 billion in additional defense spending, $20 billion to counter people who had used implements that you could buy at Home Depot for $3-4. There was no reason for that except, okay, we'll have $20 billion. Now, maybe you could justify that if that money was going to be spent for people to learn Arabic or Farsi or to learn geography or learn something about the history of the world or to learn how to get the FBI and CIA to talk to each other or learn, you know, how to get customs to be a little more suspicious of people coming from Saudi Arabia with visas or to investigate what this was all about. But instead, what they did is they took plans off the shelf for weapons that were designed not only to fight the old Soviet Union, but to fight what the Soviet Union was supposed to be building in terms of new sophisticated radar and weaponry. And they now had a green light, they felt, for building these weapons. And as a result, we've had this incredible spending spree. And we are now, as illogically as it is, we are now at a point where we are spending more on the military than at any point during the Cold War, more, and we're talking real dollars here, accounting for inflation, more than during the Vietnam War, more than during the Korean War, and we spend more than all of the other nations in the world combined. So that's where we are now. And so when I say the gift of 9/11, I know it borders on a kind of sick joke, but the fact is they seized upon 9/11 for both mercenary reasons of you know, profit and so forth, but as well as ideological reasons of a notion of imperial America setting everything straight in the world, and to build weapon systems that, unfortunately, for their argument, they can't find an enemy to justify it.
So, Robert, other kinds of spending that might protect human life on a day-to-day basis, things like health care and domestic crime prevention and the environment, are typically subjected to vigorous debates. Sometimes they pass, sometimes they don't. What do you think makes national security spending sacrosanct?
Well, you know, one of the points I tried to make in my book is that, you know, it's not as if we haven't been warned. The founding fathers were very clear that a republic and an empire were incompatible. They had the experience of Europe. They understood. And that's why they stressed local control. That's why they warned about foreign engagements, George Washington's farewell address, you know, foreign entanglements, Jefferson's word. And very, very aware that if you build an empire, if you follow an imperial route, that you will not have citizen control. And I know as a journalist, I worked for the Los Angeles Times for 30 years. When I covered local politics, when I covered, you know, should we build a streetlight? Should we have an extra school? Are the police corrupt? You know, when I covered those kind of issues, the public, the citizenry, had no difficulty at all being informed. They could find out, are the schools working? What are the test scores? Do we need another traffic light? You know, is the city councilman corrupt? When you move away from the local to the national, it's more difficult. But when you move to the international, national security, war, peace, it is impossible to have an informed citizenry because the basic information is too easily concealed from you in the name of national security, classification, enemy at the gate. We can't let our guard down. And we've seen this in the so-called war on terror. Instead of treating terrorism as a pathology and using surgical procedures to get rid of it and you know, treat an illness, a profound illness, we use the war analogy. And in wartime, I'm not the first person to point out, truth is the first casualty. And that is because representative government simply ceases to function. You can't get at the basic information sometimes for 20 years, maybe never. In Vietnam, we went to war over a supposed attack in the Gulf of Tonkin, and it wasn't until 20 years ago we learned that President Johnson was aware, before he went to the nation justifying the attack on North Vietnam, that in fact there probably hadn't been a battle at sea, and then in a matter of hours they learned, no, there hadn't been an attack. So basic information is very easily kept from the public, and fear trumps the debate. And the media goes along because they're afraid, and they're intimidated by this, and the politicians go along. So I think that the reason why you have such critical examination of your domestic spending is because the public can get in the act, and there's a debate and so forth. But when you are talking about military spending, there's no discussion. And the example you were alluding to, insuring children, President Bush vetoed a bill to extend health care to 4 million uninsured children that would have cost $7 billion. And that thing was passed by a bipartisan vote of Congress, and he still vetoed it as excessive, wasteful, not efficient. At the same time, they authorized two submarines that cost $2.5 billion apiece, so it's like almost the whole expense of insuring 4 million children to fight an enemy that doesn't have a rowboat. It's absurd.
Robert Scheer is my guest. His new book is called "The Pornography of Power: How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America." You referred earlier to Vietnam. It's very interesting because you actually had to go back as part of the exercise, I guess, of writing this book and look once again at Richard Nixon. And you have called him a horrible man who should have been tried for war crimes. But you do think now that there are some things that he got right.
Well, I went back and looked at it in the mid-1980s. And, you know, it's very nice as a journalist. Yes, I was very critical of Nixon and remain so. And I think that his escalation of the war in Vietnam, in which, you know, tens of thousands of Americans died and millions of Vietnamese and other Indochinese people died, I think rises to the level of a war crime. And so I don't want to let Richard Nixon off the hook here. But I do think, when I went back and wrote about this in the 80s. I tried to more objectively evaluate his administration and decided that on domestic issues, he was really a moderate. He believed in environmental protection. He believed in a guaranteed annual income. It was an idea he got from Senator Moynihan, which now, these days would be considered communism or something. On domestic issues, Nixon was would be by today's standards a flaming liberal. But on international policy, the reason he incurred the wrath of the neoconservatives, who were grouped around Democratic Senator Scoop Jackson, Henry Jackson, people like Richard Pearl and Wolfowitz and others, the reason he incurred their wrath is because he broke the back of the Cold War. Richard Nixon said communism is not internationalist, it's nationalist, something we should have known because there had been a Sino-Soviet dispute going back to the late 20s. And in fact, Stalin preferred Chiang Kai-shek to Mao Zedong, and so anyone knew that who spent a little time looking at the history. But Richard Nixon, rather late in the day, said, look, this whole Cold War thing is based on a fallacy. The fact is the Chinese communists and the Russian communists have nothing in common. They hate each other. And he didn't apply it to Vietnam, which, after all, had been occupied by China for 1,000 years. So he still kept up that mythology. We're fighting the communists in Vietnam. But at the same time, he and Kissinger went to Beijing. They embraced the bloodiest communist leader of them all, Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, and they broke the back of the Cold War because they said, we can do business with these people. So I wrote all that, and Richard Nixon, amazingly enough, wrote me a letter saying he'd read my article and he agreed with it and would like to, we should talk. So I went back to New York and I talked to him and I interviewed him for the LA Times, and it was a very interesting conversation. The reason I bring it up in my Pornography of Power book is that I'm trying to show the hold of wrong ideas on foreign policy. Despite knowing that the Vietnamese communists were nationalists, were not an extension of China, he still escalated the war. So there's an enormous disconnect in our both the factual basis and the logic in thinking about foreign adventure. Once you get into foreign adventure, you really lose. You don't apply the amount of disciplined reasoning you would apply to figuring out which soap powder to buy in a department store. You know, it's like today. I don't know what the price of gas is in Dallas. I know in Los Angeles, it's 4-something, 4.40 or 4.30 or something.
Yeah, it's in the 3.90s here in most places.
Okay, Paul Wolfowitz told us that the oil in Iraq would pay for the war and the occupation, okay? The price of oil has gone up sixfold under President George Bush since he had Iraq as, invasion in mind. Sixfold. So, obviously imperialism doesn't pay. May benefit some companies, and it may benefit some individuals and some politicians. It doesn't pay for the average person. While we go following this very old-fashioned, discredited imperial model, and occupy Iraq, the Chinese, even though they're still called communists, are acting like old-fashioned capitalists and pre-market capitalists, and they're going around the world buying up energy contracts. And their economy hasn't been hurt.
They're financing our military growth.
Well, I think the most bizarre twist in all this thing, because the hawks can't really make a case that we need this huge military apparatus to fight, terrorists. That's absurd. And by the way, John McCain, one of the sad things in this election is no one knows that better than John McCain. I mean, John McCain as a senator has been one of the better members of Congress in holding the military-industrial complex accountable.
Robert, let me stop you there. We need to take a break, and I want to make sure that we have time to make the full point. Robert Scheer is my guest. He's the editor of TruthDig.com. His new book is called The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. We'll return to our conversation in just a minute. We will hear about the role of China in the New World Order and what that means to United States policy.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the editor-in-chief of TruthDig.com, Robert Scheer. His new book is called The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So as we were speaking before, Robert, even those who will agree that we're spending inappropriately to defend ourselves against terrorism will point out that there are still states that could pose a threat. Namely, a lot of people are concerned about China.
Well, you know, this whole thing of threat inflation, I mean, again, I'm not going to say there aren't any threats ever in the world, but I just wonder why the appraisal has to become so irrational. You know, we have information on what China does. I mean, China is the boogeyman of the moment because it's very difficult to make a case that these rogue nations or the terrorists pose a threat that warrants a huge military buildup. Because they don't have the arsenal. They just don't have it. And we have had an arsenal before this big buildup that humbled the old Soviet Union, and that doesn't exist. So you have to find a state player that is determined to take you on. And yet, in my book, I quote the 207, the Defense Department is required to inform Congress about its appraisal of threats out there. And in their appraisal of China in 207, which is quoted in my book, they say China will take until the end of the decade or longer to become a regional player, to take on a moderate enemy. And the example they offer is Taiwan. So there's not even a hint anywhere that China has the capacity or is moving in the direction of taking on the United States, of becoming a rival in any way, or becoming the new Soviet Union. China's just not doing it. There's simply no evidence to support that. And as I say, the assessment of our own intelligence community of the Defense Department is at most China would aspire, as the Defense Department reports says, their main concern is Taiwan and preventing Taiwan breaking away, okay? Now, we just had a development last week, and the mass media is so, I don't know what the right word is, whether it's lazy or stupid or what, but you had this development where for the first time since 1949, the leader of the people who fled mainland China and took over Taiwan, the Kuomintang, Chiang Kai-shek's old people, the leader of that party, which happens to be in power, they won an election, and they won an election on the basis that they were going to have a rapprochement with the mainland, that they were going to have better relations, and even the rival candidate also favored better, improved relations. The leader of the Kuomintang went to mainland China, the first such visit since 1949, and with the blessings of the new president of Taiwan, who talked about a new chapter of peace, they had this incredible detente developed. And right now you have negotiations with the official body from Taiwan, official one from China, over direct flights, over increase in tourism. Taiwan is already the number two investor in mainland China. So the whole prospect of a China-Taiwan war, which is the only scenario you can imagine, China has shown absolutely no interest in conquest of anyone else. The Tibet issue, which keeps coming up, has nothing to do with expansion worldwide. It has to do with their obsession with what is China and their border. Same thing, their fight with Vietnam over islands that they've been fighting about for 1,000 years. But if they, as every there's every indication that the Taiwan issue, the cross-strait issue, is going the route of peaceful diplomatic solution rather than military, there'll be absolutely no incentive for Chinese militarization. And as I said before, the Chinese are following a very old-fashioned capitalist free market model of go build stuff that people want to buy. And their competition, it's interesting. We fought the war in Vietnam against communist Vietnam. They're still a communist country. By the way, John McCain led the fight in the Senate along with John Kerry to normalize relations with communist Vietnam, despite being shot down over there. We now know the Vietnam War never made any sense. Communist Vietnam is not a threat to our security. And what happened after we got out of Vietnam? Everybody says, now you can't get out of Iraq. We have to be strong. Appeaser if you suggest a more peaceful course. We lost in the most ignominious defeat we've ever had in our history in Vietnam. And what happened? Communist Vietnam and Communist China went to war. That's what happened. They went to war over a historic border dispute. And now, what is the tension between Communist Vietnam and Communist China? It's for shelf space at Walmart or Costco. And this is the reality. And no one wants to factor that reality. And so when you raise the question, it's a legitimate question because it's what the hawks say. Yes, of course, we can't justify all these subs and everything and the F-35 new multi-service fighter that will end up with bringing $300 billion in sales, or the F-22 plane, for the Raptor for $65 billion. We can't justify that. We're talking about terrorists, but China's coming. Well, China's not coming.
Well, what's so interesting about China, Robert, is that its rise as a global power has come from it being an economic power, and none of that happened until it sort of allowed other interests within its own government to supersede military interests.
Yeah, of course. And what we've learned with China is that, again, nationalism trumped ideology, and that nationalism could work out in as opposed to a rigid ideology, nationalism could go in a lot of directions. A nationalism could say, we want to host the Olympics. Nationalism could say, unfortunately, we must control Tibet. There's a downside of nationalism, clearly. But nationalism also can say, we want to feed our people better. We want to be prosperous. We want to be the envy of the world. And the Chinese have followed that model. And as a result, they're training large numbers of engineers. They're very effectively working the world market. And they're laughing up their sleeves as they carry our debt, a significant portion of our debt, charges interest, while we use that money to build weapons ostensibly to counter the threat from China. I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
Robert Scheer is my guest. He's the editor of TruthDig.com. His new book is called The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak first to Charlie in Willow Park. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Chris. How are y'all?
Great, thank you.
A couple of things that are very wrong about what Mr. Scheer is saying. First of all, not us. The Australians are scared, brainless, of Indonesia getting the Sukhoi modern fighters because they're being sold all over the world by the Russians. They need money. You're right. It's all about money. And I'm no hawk, but I can tell you that the Chinese have 135 of those aircraft on order in a co-production agreement. As well, there are a couple of other problems like double-digit SAMs with 100 nautical mile ranges that you're not mentioning at all, that cut off major geopolitical areas from our allies. Gee, you might pay a little attention to that because those are real threats. And, did you consider any of those for your book?
Well, let's get a response. Thanks for your call, Charlie.
Well, look, there's no question that people around the world are buying arms and are building dangerous weapon systems and so forth. So the question is whether the weapons we're building do anything to counter such a danger. And clearly building, for instance, the subs that I referred to, or the F-22, for instance. All right, let's take that, the Raptor. It doesn't do anything to add to our forces. Lawrence Korb, who was the Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, who's written extensively about it, call it the most useless weapon system the Pentagon is developing right now. So if you look at the reality in the world, there is no force out there that threatens the United States in any way. There is no force that cannot easily be overcome by the United States for 30 years to come. That's just the reality. I'm sorry. The Soviets can build. Yes, the Soviets are in the business of trying to make money off the arms trade. There's no question about it. It's one of the things that they seem to be able to do, but they don't match us in technology. They don't have a force that in any way rivals us. Their subs leak. They can't even leave port. Their military is. Our main concern about the Soviets is that their corruption and people stealing nuclear material and selling it elsewhere. We are actively working on programs now with the Soviets, Russians, to guard their resources and not have them fall into other hands. As far as the threat of missiles and nuclear weapons, I think McCain was right the other day when he said we should be more cooperative with the Russians in trying to control this stuff. But I think the idea of pointing to Indonesia, is Indonesia whatever planes it has, Indonesia is going to be a threat that the United States couldn't deal with in a matter of hours. It's just not true. And, you know, look at what happened with Iraq. I mean, Saddam Hussein was supposed to have this fearsome arsenal and fearsome force and everything, and it just collapsed in a matter of hours. And so if you just look at the statistics, you look at the weaponry, there is no rival force. I mean, as I said earlier, the Soviet Union did represent a very significant military force. The collapse of the Soviet Union was as dramatic an event as you can have as we've ever had in human history. It's a welcome event. We can argue about who deserves the credit, whether it was Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon or Gorbachev. We can have a lively discussion, but you cannot deny that fact. And then for the United States to now be building even more sophisticated weapons, the Soviets are not building weapons that could challenge our authority. They're not developing a submarine fleet that can in any way challenge our existing submarine fleet. So you just get into the sort of never-never land, I think, in the debate. And I'm perfectly willing to have that debate. I'm perfectly, by the way, as a taxpayer, I'm perfectly willing to support any weapon system or any military buildup that's justified. You know, that's not the issue here. I'm all for better body armor for troops if you're going to send them somewhere. I'm all for spending money on translators so you understand who these people are that you're arresting. I'm all for spending more money on intelligence if you can actually get good intelligence. I'm very much in favor of learning Arabic and Farsi and learning something about the history of these countries. I'm also in favor of programs that have been cut back that would allow us to cooperate more with people in solving their problems. You know, that's not the issue here. The issue is, when you have a military force that has humbled the greatest power that the world had other than our own, that doesn't exist anymore, why are you building even more advanced systems?
Well, let's talk about, you know, when we hear this loaded term military-industrial complex, we think about weapons that are used by the United States. But to what extent are U.S. companies outfitting military operations in the rest of the world?
Well, that's a very good point. And by the way, the military-industrial complex, I don't think is a loaded phrase. I mean, first of all, it's Eisenhower was the one who used it, and I think and he explained what he meant by it, is that people develop an interest in an economic interest, a psychological interest, everything else, political interest, in keeping this thing going even when it doesn't make sense. But I think your point about sales is a valid one. For instance, these more advanced planes that we're talking about, we sell them to the world. You know, your caller talked about Indonesia buying some Russian planes. Well, we sell advanced planes. We have sold advanced planes to Pakistan that can carry nuclear weapons. You know, we said we went to Iraq to prevent the weapons of mass destruction. Well, Pakistan has weapons of mass destruction, and they have planes that can carry those weapons of mass destruction, and we sold them to them, you know. And we looked the other way as Pakistan was developing those weapons, and we looked the other way as Pakistan was proliferating nuclear technology. After all, it was Khan in Pakistan who was responsible for nuclear technology getting to Libya, to Iran, to North Korea, and this was happening while we were distracted with other matters. So, you know, I'm not suggesting that there isn't a problem of the proliferation of conventional as well as nuclear weapons in the world. It very much alarms me that nations are developing nuclear weapons. I don't think it helps that the United States itself, the one country that has ever killed people with these weapons consciously, as opposed to a peaceful plant exploding, but has consciously killed hundreds of thousands of people with these weapons, that we still say they're usable, and that under the Bush administration we're developing even more advanced nuclear weapons, and we've expanded the budget for nuclear weaponry. So I think we have some real contradictions in our position, but the point of my book is not to suggest that the arms proliferation is an unimportant issue in the world. I think it's truly alarming. I think we have to set the example, though, of controlling these weapons, of saying that war is counterproductive to human interests, that imperialism does not pay. And, you know, it's sort of an odd position. Who would have imagined 30 years ago or even 10, 20 years ago that one would say, hey, let's follow the Chinese example? The Chinese communists actually believe in international capitalism of an old-fashioned kind, and we believe in imperialism of a previous era. We believe in what the Spanish did when they tried to conquer America, or the French, or, you know, the German. I mean, it's bizarre.
Robert Scheer is my guest. Let's go next to Arlington and talk to Tom. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, I like what you're saying about past presidents, and even if you go back to Eisenhower, who was really a general, he really stressed economic infrastructure and public education as the critical Cold War needs, even more important than soldiers and weapons. I mean, he built interstate highways, he improved science education, improved the public schools, and because he knew these things were more important than just soldiers and weapons, you know, in the struggle against the Soviets. So I guess my question is, why have we lost this emphasis? And even though Republicans are supposed to be pro-economy, we seem to have a decaying infrastructure, decaying educational system, really a technology that's not nearly as competitive as it was in the 60s and 70s compared to other countries. And we worry more about taking our shoes off at the airport and immigrants crossing the border to work for us than we do about, you know, things that China and India are worrying about, which is educating people and building more robust economy, which is really what wins, even in military conflicts over the long term.
Well, I certainly agree with that, and I think it goes to, you know, what do we mean by national security, and is knowing Farsi, knowing what's going on in Iran. You know, this is a country we've messed around with now for half a century. We taxpayers, our CIA. I once did a story. I interviewed Kermit Roosevelt, who was the top CIA guy who overthrew Mossadegh in Iran. Okay, I interviewed him for the Los Angeles Times when he was close to his death. And you know, here we messed around in that country's history for 50 years. We overthrew the last secular, popular, elected person in Iran. Then we backed the Shah, and we created the groundwork for the Ayatollah and this religious fanaticism. So here's a very important country that we have screwed around with for 50 years, and by the way, now expanded their power enormously by our invasion of Iraq. We knocked out their historic opponent, who we had backed in the Iraq-Iran war. Remember when Rumsfeld was over there, you know, cheering them on, and the Reagan administration.
Let's take a break, Robert. You'll have time to finish in just a minute. Robert Scheer is my guest. His new book is called The Pornography of Power: How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. You can get on the line to join us, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the editor-in-chief of TruthDig.com. His new book is called The Pornography of Power: How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. He's Robert Scheer. Robert, before the break, you were talking about Iran and the fact that for half a century we have tried to exert control to little effect these days.
Well, and also there's the blowback, and it turns out to be so counterproductive. So we've messed around in a country for half a century, and the situation is worse by our own president's acknowledgement than it's ever been. We went to war against a historic enemy, a guy we had supported against Iran earlier, Saddam Hussein. We removed the main obstacle to their expansion, so I don't think anyone would question that Iran's influence now in the region, which extends from Lebanon, Hezbollah, which it sponsors, to Iraq, where people who were in exile in Iran against Saddam Hussein for decades are now in power in the Green Zone. So their influence is enormous, not just with the militia in Iraq, but with the people who are the government that we're backing. And they've never been in a stronger position, and weakens us in our ability to deal with whatever threat they present in terms of nuclear weapons. We're obviously not holding the high cards at this point. And when we think about it, it kind of comes and goes. You know, Ronald Reagan gave them arms because he was more concerned about Latin America. It's the kind of thinking you would not accept in a seventh grade student. You wouldn't accept it in your young child. It's irrational. And so when we try to think about what Iran, now you have a situation, McCain and even Hillary Clinton were blasting Barack Obama for saying he would talk to them. You know, McCain, by the way, who was in favor of talking to Hamas at one point, which I think is legitimate. And by the way, we mentioned Dwight Eisenhower before. The greatest thing Dwight Eisenhower did other than helping win World War II, was as president, he brought Khrushchev over to the United States. The dread Soviet leader brought him to the United States and said, look at the wheat fields of Kansas. Look at the corn, you know. Look at what we grow here, and then tell me why we're fighting. And that's what started the end of the Cold War, was Eisenhower's saying, hey, we can do business with these people. They should see who we are. We should see. He favored diplomacy, okay? And that time he was attacked. Why are you bringing Khrushchev to the United States? So here Barack Obama dares to suggest talking to these people. No, that's not considered tough-minded and rational. No, let's be belligerent. So you have a situation with Iran. The reason I bring that up is at one point I read a report that we had people in the State Department, only seven really were could do classical Arabic, and a similar number knew Farsi. And I pointed out to people, my God, you go to a Starbucks in Westwood near UCLA, and where I live in Los Angeles, and there are more people on any given day in a Starbucks who know Farsi and classical Arabic than there are in the State Department. Now, clearly, from going to what your previous caller said, from a national security point of view, we need to know some languages here. We need to know something about the religion. We need to know something about the history. And we also have to be aware of the previous role that we have played in the history of this country. After all, you know, here you have 9/11, which has triggered all this. Where did the people who did 9/11 come from? What were they doing in Afghanistan? It's a question you almost how did bin Laden get to be in Afghanistan? How did Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, get to be in Afghanistan? And how did they meet? You read the 9/11 Commission report, they met in Afghanistan where they both were recruited by our own CIA. We brought them to Afghanistan, that wonderful foreign adventure to stop the Soviets. You know, we wouldn't go to the Olympics in 1980. Zbigniew Brzezinski and Jimmy Carter, who's turned out to be the best ex-president we ever had, wasn't so good as a president, and he decided he had to have another, give the Russians their Vietnam, were the words that Zbigniew Brzezinski used, in Afghanistan. So there's blowback, there's consequence. And to my mind, that what's appalling, and I'm not, getting any younger here, it's appalling that we're arguing about the same kind of inanities and stupidities. It's just there's something weird about it, that when we talk about the most important area of public policy, it becomes mindless. You know, absolutely. The example I used earlier, why isn't anyone appraising what does this opening from Taiwan to mainland China mean for American foreign policy? Should we ratchet down the, anti-Chinese military rhetoric? Should we reappraise what's going on? Maybe, this is a positive development we should get behind. There's absolutely no interest on the talk shows and the mass media or anything. It's just insignificant,
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Jonathan in Fort Worth. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, how you doing today?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, I'm not getting any younger myself, although I'm working on that potion. But I thought I'd share a few thoughts, because I don't think everything in the book as it's being presented is in any way, shape, or form something that of value. In other words, whether it's more language speakers or a different way to approach weapon systems or not, or different diplomacies, such as when Taiwan or China start talking. You know, I agree with all that, but it's unfortunately it gets laced on both sides. Conservatives do this also. And I don't know whether you consider yourself a liberal, progressive, or moderate. That's not what I mean when I say conservatives do this also. But people lace their remarks with things like, well, we were the only nation to drop a bomb, consciously. And that's true. And it did kill hundreds of thousands. But it was a war. People had died. And we had a very tough decision for Harry Truman to make that I know I wouldn't want to have to make, to be honest. That's a tough decision. So, I mean, when you lace that in, on either side of the fence, whether you're conservative, liberal, or even if you're moderate, you include that kind of comment in something, people look at that and they go, well, this guy wants to disarm us. He wants to take the rights of the United States away and throw them out the door. He ignores that if we go into an L.A. coffee shop and pick up these Farsi speakers or Arabic speakers, well, they could be agents. You know, people have maligned McCarthy to the point where they ignore the thousands, literally thousands of people who are funneling information out of this country. Now, that doesn't mean I advocate what McCarthy does is right. But it does mean there were, even in our internment camps, which were wrong to do, it was the wrong approach. I think we see that 60 years later quite clearly. But the point is there were spies there. And we've got to look for that middle ground, and we don't do it by egging each other on or shooting for a little better sale or a stabbing comment. I think the intelligence, the experience, and the value of your guest is to be taken in such a way, it's so important for this nation on each side, this is a man of value, that when those remarks come up, it undermines the excellent stuff that's out there on each side. You know, conservatives,
Jonathan,
love this nation.
Thank you so much for your call. I want to make sure that we have time for a response to you.
Thank you so much. I agree. I mean, I begin my prologue saying it was odd to be with Richard Nixon alone. Odd yet that what he had to say made so much sense, more than the four other presidents I have interviewed. So I am certainly in favor of a bipartisan position. Let me just tell you, if John McCain had come out against the Iraq War, and John McCain had stuck to his ideas on campaign financing more consistently, and if he could stuck to his really terrific position opposing torture, which he's now backed off, I'd have a hard time figuring out who to vote for in this election. You know, the reason I bring up the dropping of the bomb, by the way, it was done by a Democratic president, and the bomb was created by liberals. And it was created by people, by the way, who were later called pacifists, like Oppenheimer. And the Vietnam War was a Democratic president's war, and it was done by the best and the brightest, and probably the main people doing it, certainly Robert McNamara, considered themselves liberals. My comment was not intended as a partisan one or as a frivolous one. I think the decision to drop the bomb was a complex decision. But the reason I brought it up is that at a time when we should be very concerned about the proliferation of nuclear weapons, we should recognize that we, as the one nation that, first of all, developed the weapon, used the weapon, and continues to insist that, and this administration insists that this is a usable weapon and we are developing even better nuclear weapons or more effective nuclear weapons, we should recognize that we have had a hand in the development of the nuclear weapons age that torments us. So that's the reason to bring it up, is to then say we have a special responsibility to try to put this genie back in the bottle before we end a life on this earth.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Larry in North Dallas. Hi, Larry.
Hi. What happens if there's Hamas keeps prodding Israel with missile attacks? And what happens if the Israelis decide they're going to take things in hand and just march into the Gaza Strip and just hunt these guys down using both air, tanks, and, full military weight? And then they get trouble from Hezbollah in the north. What do we do?
Well, what do you want us to do?
I don't know. I think the Israelis could take care of themselves if we don't get these, crybabies saying, oh, they're hurting people. Children and all that.
Well, I see where you're going. Let me just say, can I jump in here?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. What I'm saying, I think that, let me tell you, I was in Israel and in the West Bank at the time of the Six-Day War. I'm that old. And I interviewed Moshe Dayan and Aaron and so forth, and I had been in Egypt before, and so I covered that a bit. And I'll tell you something. The people who won the Six-Day War, Moshe Dayan and others, had it evolved to where it is today, they would be shocked, and they would see this as a betrayal of Zionism, because they knew in their gut that the occupation of another people would not bring you security. And this has been a disaster, a continuing and deepening disaster. And where I fault our administration in this regard is I don't want to wait for the point where they're fighting on all fronts. I want to know what happened to the peace process. And we had a moment of considerable success, not just one moment. We had it under several presidents going back to Carter, but we certainly had it under Clinton. This administration came in and dropped the ball on the peace talks, and it has never been in any serious way pursued. On the contrary, what we did was we gave a blank check to the hard line, and most Israelis, by the way, would favor serious peace negotiations. They know there isn't really a long-run, satisfactory military solution. One-fifth of Israel's population, and I'm not talking about the occupied area, one-fifth of Israel's population are Arabic right now. The demographics are moving in a direction where you're going to end up with a majority of non-Jews in the combined territory, and I think very few Israelis think that is a stable situation. And so I think there, more than probably any place else in the world, the military solution does not work. And I think, by the way, in terms of the arguments of my book, I have a big chapter on Israel, because Israel's response to their stalemate or defeat or whatever it was in the last Lebanon war was to say, we don't need more high-tech weapons. We have to learn to be more effective on the ground. And they actually canceled their order for some of the high-tech American equipment. I might also point out one of the little ironies in the world today when we talk about the Chinese are coming. Israel is one of the governments that's been accused of supplying China with high-tech equipment and knowledge that they got from the United States, like the Harvey and so forth, unmanned drone. And so it's a complex world out there, and all I'm trying to argue in my book is don't make it more dangerous and more complex by building weapons that you don't need, that bankrupt your country and take resources away from programs that would, in fact, make us more secure, be they international programs, be they intelligent military programs, or be they, as one of your callers said, spending money on things that really make you a great nation, like an educational system that works.
In just the couple of minutes we have left, Robert, I want to go back to something that I don't know that it points out once again how old you are, but you wrote...
I'm 72 years old. I'm not the least bit embarrassed about it. I do 4 miles on the treadmill, and I'm very happy.
Good for you. You wrote...
And by the way, I still pay taxes, and I have to pay taxes on my Social Security, and I hate the demonization of seniors that I keep hearing. I never plan to retire, and I'm not a drain on the economy.
Okay.
Go on.
Noted. Thank you. You wrote probably the best known, most quoted article ever in the history of Playboy magazine. You were the guy who got Jimmy Carter to admit that he had lusted in his heart. Did you know at the time when he told you that, did you think this is something that people will remember for decades?
No, first of all, I didn't get him to do it. This old thing about don't hustle a hustler. And Jimmy Carter was trying to show he was a regular guy. Remember, it was the Democrats who first wore religion on their sleeve. It was Jimmy Carter who talked about being born again and Plains Baptist Church and all that stuff. And so he wanted to prove he was a regular guy. And what he said was actually a totally non-controversial statement. And it's actually makes sense in terms of Scripture that we do lust in our heart and we have to struggle with that. That's all he was saying. And there was nothing. I was amazed that that became the big item, because what he said was something that caused a great deal of controversy when we landed in Dallas and Lady Bird Johnson would not meet with him. And because he said in that interview, I said, how are you going to avoid getting into other Vietnams? And because it was a Democratic war, and Jimmy Carter said, I wouldn't lie the way Lyndon Johnson did. Hmm. And for a guy running for president as a Democrat to have said that about the Democratic president was, I thought, quite provocative. And Lady Bird Johnson refused to meet with Jimmy Carter. And had the lust thing not been in there, that would have been the big controversy. It was at first, and then lust, as it has a way of doing, overwhelmed everything.
You did name your book Pornography of Power.
I named Pornography of Power because I think it's apt. It has struck me following these events.
I'm so sorry. I've led you into that.
It's
now
not the real thing.
We're out of time. I know exactly what you mean. The book is called Pornography of Power. Robert Scheer is the author. Robert, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.